I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Eric Balkin. He grew up in Salt Lake City, building a connection to Utah's mountains, rivers, and deserts at a young age. In his youth, Eric volunteered with local nonprofits, gaining experience in public land surveys, membership outreach, and grassroots organizing. Eric has been deeply involved with Colorado River policy for the past decade, helping spearhead multiple research and advocacy initiatives at GCI. Eric has a bachelor's degree in environmental studies and geography from the University of Utah and serves as an advisor on the Future of Colorado group. And so two questions, really. First off, can you tell listeners what GCI stands for? And then second, can you tell us a little bit about the Glen Canyon?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Really excited to be here. And GCI stands for Glen Canyon Institute. We are a advocacy organization with a mission to restore Glen Canyon and a free-flowing Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. And for those of your listeners who are not aware or familiar with Glen Canyon is right north of the Grand Canyon. And hopefully everyone is familiar with where the Grand Canyon is. So Glen Canyon is at the heart of the Colorado River Basin. It is the heart of the Colorado Plateau. Before it was drowned by the waters of Lake Powell from Glen Canyon Dam, which was completed in 1963, many considered Glen Canyon to be the heart and soul of the Colorado River system. So, you know, if you're thinking about where this place is geographically, the bottom of Glen Canyon is on the Utah-Arizona border. It is surrounded by national parks and monuments. As I mentioned, to the south of it is Grand Canyon National Park. To the west is Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. To the north is Canyonlands National Park. And to the east is Bears Ears National Monument. So Glen Canyon is surrounded by some of the Colorado Plateau's most prized parks and monuments and protected land. And, you know, the further out you go, there's just more and more of those parks and monuments. But Glen Canyon is at the heart of all of that.
And so how can you, sorry if this is a really stupid question, but how old is Glen Canyon and how did it start?
Oh, that might be a really smart question that I'm not fully able to answer. From a geological question, I wouldn't even pretend to know. You know, I could look it up on Wikipedia and tell you how old the rock formations are, right? I don't know if that's the question you're asking.
Well, it's okay. So let's get some basics. Like, how deep is it? How wide is it? How was it, I guess? And how long? We know that Arizona is pretty dry. So also, can you then get into some of the flora and fauna of the region, especially before it was flooded? So the what I'm asking about really is the flora and fauna down in the canyon, especially.
Yeah. So, you know, just for a rough scale of things, Glen Canyon technically, I guess, is about 186 miles in length. So it's just a little bit shorter than the Grand Canyon National Park unit. Width-wise, you know, I don't really know. It's Glen Canyon is this labyrinth of side canyons. And so it's not easy to just look at it as a blob on a map and just say this is the surface area. Glen Canyon is home to over 125 side canyons by some accounts. These are tributary canyons that have often perennially flowing streams and ephemeral streams, and then, you know, they're the tributary rivers of Glen Canyon. So we sort of focus on the Colorado River as the main stem, but we also have coming in from the east the San Juan River. And from the west, we have the Escalante and Dirty Devil River. So you have, you know, some pretty significant tributary rivers coming into this sandstone canyon system. And then you have these over 100 side canyons. And side canyon is a non-technical term. And the side canyons have side canyons, and those side canyons have side canyons. So when you're looking at a map of Glen Canyon, which I would encourage people to do, it's really fun to zoom around on Google Earth. It really is just this network of slot canyons and swerving sinuous sandstone gullies that are all unique in their own way. They all have their own character, their own personality, and they are really important from an ecological perspective. So when we're thinking about ecologically what Glen Canyon was and even is today in a lot of senses, it was a really important place on the Colorado River ecologically. So it's a, there's some ambiguity, or I guess maybe that's not the right word. There's a lot we don't know about this river system before the dams were built. When Glen Canyon Dam was completed in 1963, we didn't really have environmental laws. There was no NEPA. There was no National Environmental Policy Act that required a thorough study of the ecosystems and what the impacts of the project would be. And so, like nowadays, we have really advanced fish biologists that are looking at fish up and down the Colorado River system, and we know quite a bit about what's going on with the fish these days, but we didn't really know before. But after Glen Canyon Dam was completed, and this river system became much more compartmentalized, we see that four of the fish species on in this system, and I believe there are seven endemic species on the Colorado River system. Four of them became endangered. One of them just got downlisted, the humpback chub, which is a good thing because the population came back. I think it should still be seen as a very threatened species. It's of concern for sure. But essentially, these dams, with Glen Canyon Dam sort of being the nail in the coffin, it compartmentalized this river system. It inundated 186 miles of the Colorado River and the San Juan River and the Escalante River, and sort of choked off the sediment, the free flow of nutrients down into the Grand Canyon, and caused four of these fish to become endangered. And so that's, just looking at sort of the aquatic ecosystems and the changes that happened there. But, with all these canyons, as I mentioned, many of them have streams flowing in them. So when we think about southern Utah and Arizona, we think of it as a really dry place. But Glen Canyon's actually a very wet place. When you get down into the canyons, Glen Canyon isn't super deep. There are places where the cliffs are probably 500 or 700 feet high. A lot of them are a few hundred feet high. It's not quite as sheer and deep as the Grand Canyon is. It's a lot more inviting and friendly. The Grand Canyon is a mile deep, and it's got these tumultuous rapids for hundreds of miles. Glen Canyon was really soft and gentle, and had some ripples, but it wasn't a big whitewater stretch of river. It was really calm, and it was thought to be a really important place for those native fish species. It had all these tributary canyons, the backwaters, glens, alcoves, places that were probably really suitable for these endemic fish species on the river, who expressed, many of them have migratory habits, especially fish like the Colorado pike minnow. Which I think would grow to be 50 or 60 years old. They believe that it would migrate all the way near the Sea of Cortez. I don't think it went into the ocean. I don't think it was an anadromous fish, but it would migrate, from basically the Sea of Cortez up to Wyoming. And when the dams were built, they sort of cut those off. But in Glen Canyon, you've got all these tributary side canyons coming in, and they are full of life. They're full of native plant species like cottonwoods and willows and fun little ponds and little micro environments in there, and they're really teeming with life. And so our focus, as I mentioned, we're focused on the restoration of Glen Canyon. A lot of these ecosystems were lost, but so many of them are bouncing back, and it's just so incredible to see. But this place is just full of life. It's full of animals, mule deer, bighorn sheep, beaver, otter, tons of birds, snakes, frogs, insects, bees. We did a fun trip with some biologists a few years ago where they just discovered a new species of bee just while we were walking around. I mean, Glen Canyon is just teeming with life, and it's because it has water, right? So it's obviously the general landscape, that part of the plateau is very dry, but right to next to Glen Canyon to the east is Navajo Mountain, and to the west is the Kaparowitz Plateau, due north a bit are the Henry Mountains. So you have all these plateaus and mountains surrounding this canyon, which means that there's a pretty consistent inflow of groundwater that feeds seeps and springs. It's a very magical place, and it's no wonder why it was so treasured by the people who knew it, the writers and explorers, quote unquote, who went and saw it, and the river runners in the 1950s who knew it, and of course the Native American people who were living in Glen Canyon.
So I know that this would change by the mile and maybe by the 100 feet, but how much? So you have the river itself in the canyon. How wide would often the land be on each side? Was it a fairly narrow? Because I grew up in Colorado and there are some gorges there where you've got 6 inches between the water itself and the steep canyon up. And then you can go to, sort of oxbow creeks and they meander all back and forth. Was this a fairly, again, I know I'm generalizing over 180 miles, but was it often a wide floodplain or a less wide floodplain? You see what I'm asking?
So it varies for sure. And I think most of it you could say was a pretty tight canyon, maybe half a mile wide or so. That's just a total unscientific estimation. But there were definitely sort of floodplain parts, especially up on the San Juan River. The San Juan River is a really sediment-filled river that would sort of braid back and forth. And the it's ancestral lands to the Paiute and Navajo and Hopi people. The Paiute farmed there. There was a place called Paiute Farms, and they had orchards and farming over there. And I think the soil was really perfect for it. Up near Hite, Utah, there was a family up there who had a little farm up there, kind of on some of those plains. There was a gas station and a post office, and there were definitely parts of Glen Canyon that sort of opened up like that. But for the most part of it, it's this winding sandstone river channel that's pretty tight.
And so before we move on, the next thing I want to move on to will be the Glen Canyon Dam. Before that, can you give one or two stories of either just your favorite plants or animals or your favorite history stories you've heard of? Like, I've seen some photos of the side canyons to Glen Canyon that are just, I mean, this is radio, so we can't really do them justice, but some almost dreamlike beauty. So anyway, can you give just a couple of your favorite stories about anything associated with the canyon?
Just a fun historical anecdote, which I think is pretty entertaining. There were in the 19, I think it was the 1940s, some explorers, people came down just to explore the canyon and take photos, and their dream was to have their expedition featured in National Geographic magazine. And they went down from the Escalante side, so they, I believe they hiked in from the Escalante side down into the canyons. And in that area, the Escalante tributary is just beautiful. I mean, just that river section alone could have been its own national park. That's where you see places like Cathedral in the Desert and Davis Gulch and 50 Mile Canyon and Willow Gulch and Coyote Gulch is up there. And it's just an amazing, amazing, beautiful river corridor. The upper parts of it are part of the monument. But this team of explorers is going down and they're like, man, we really want to get this in National Geographic. How do we do that? And they're like, well, maybe if this is the time when those white folks were like naming features down in Glen Canyon, because it was a place that most white folks weren't familiar with. And they were like, okay, well, they found this arch and they're like, let's name it Lagoris after the president of National Geographic magazine and see if if that gets us in the magazine. And sure enough, they had this picture of LaGorse Arch, and they got featured in the magazine. It worked. And I don't know when exactly that was, whether 1940s or 1950s, but I think that's a pretty fun story. And then, one kind of story, a personal story of mine too, is because, we're going on all these trips down there. We're taking scientists and folks with the media to just see what's coming out, incredible arches and bridges and waterfalls and alcoves. As this reservoir is drying up because of climate change, it's revealing this place that should have been a national park. So you really never know what you're going to see down there. And I was with the NPR team, and we were going into Cathedral in the Desert, which is one of the crown jewels of Glen Canyon. And I was the first to walk in. It's this, 500-foot tall wall surrounding you, kind of this overarching. I mean, it feels like a cathedral. There's like a little gap in the top where some light comes through, but it's very quiet. All you can hear is this waterfall in the distance. And we're walking in, and I look up. This is a place that's completely isolated, really, for people or animals to get in. I mean, you could rappel in and off the waterfall. It's like a canyoneering route, but this is some people do. But for wildlife, it's a place that it's really hard to get into, unless you're coming from the reservoir like we did. And we're walking in there, and this is November, and it's fall, so it's very late in the year. And I go into Cathedral in the Desert, and I there's this pile of sediment kind of in the corner of the chamber, and I look up, and there's this big buck mule deer looking down at me with a big 6-point rack. This huge deer is just in the Cathedral of the Desert. And I was like, how in the hell did this buck get into the Cathedral in the Desert? There's no trail there. I mean, and if he swam, he would have had to swim for miles. I mean, I've had no idea. I mean, you can look at this canyon on Google Earth. Like, the walls in this canyon are very steep. And I walked in. I was like, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I looked back at Nate Rott, the reporter. I was like, "Do you see that?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, I saw it." So he saw it too. I didn't imagine this. And then we walked further in, and we kind of walk up on the sediment pile to look for the deer, and it was just gone. And we hung out there for a while, and then we boated back to our camp. But we didn't see any sign of it after that. But there was just like this, it was so symbolic of how mysterious this place is. The wildlife is returning, and kind of a magical interaction. It was like, oh man, like, where did that deer come from, and where did it go?
That's one of the things that whatever optimism I have comes from the ability of animals to re-inhabit and to just appear where we didn't expect them to be. So tell us about the Glen Canyon Dam. How did it come to be? A little bit, some details about it. And then also, one of the things please include is how deep these areas were covered by water.
Yeah, so Glen Canyon Dam, commissioned in 1956, completed in 1963. It was conceived probably as early as the 1920s. To really understand why that dam was built, we have to sort of take a step back and look at the big picture of the Colorado River Basin. The Colorado River Basin is made up of the seven basin states, California, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, and then of course Mexico, and the 30 federally recognized tribes that are kind of in and around all those states. When the
Wyoming's there because, like, the Green River, right?
exactly, yep, Wyoming's a part of it because of the Green River. It's a tributary to the Colorado. When the law of the river, I guess not the law of the river per se, but the Colorado River Compact of 1922, which is sort of like the seminal piece of legislation that would define how this river would be managed. It's signed in 1922 with amongst these seven basin states, except not Arizona, because Arizona didn't like the deal and they didn't sign on, and really they couldn't come to an agreement. too much. And they just said, okay, we can't agree to how to split this river up between the seven states. And they said, well, can we agree to split it into two, an upper basin and a lower basin? They said, well, yeah, we can do that. So the lower basin comes up with their own agreement, and then the upper basin would later figure their deal out. But the key point is they split this basin into an upper basin and a lower basin. There was no real scientific reasoning to do that. It was very much politics. And that sort of sets the whole system up for disaster. The upper basin is allotted a certain amount of water. The lower basin is allotted a certain amount of water. And there's a requirement built in that the upper basin cannot prevent water from flowing down in a certain amount, or like it's called the delivery obligation. The upper basin can't use up so much water that, you know, it doesn't flow down to the lower basin states. And the lower basin states, namely California, start developing water in the early 20th century. They start building canals. You have, you know, Mulholland going and running all over California to siphon water off to LA, and they're embarking on these massive water development projects at a time when the other states in the basin really didn't have very big populations. And so you have senators and congressmen up in Utah and Colorado looking at how fast water is being developed in California, and they said to themselves, man, if we don't have a way to trap water up here in the upper basin, we'll never get a chance to use this river system. Because the way the law of the river works is that it's first in time, first in right. Whoever is there first using the water gets an you know, perpetual right to that water. Prior appropriations doctrine, it's called. And
Except,
so,
of course, for fish and cottonwood trees and humans who live there forever, but leave that aside.
of course, the policy would never take that into account. And so there's this delivery obligation that the upper basin has to deliver water downstream. There's the lower basin states just really starting, and it's California, right? I mean, these states have this animosity towards California and the lower basin, which they still have today. And that was the impetus for Glen Canyon Dam. They said, we needed a way to store water in the upper basin to meet that delivery obligation, but not send one drop more than is that we're legally required to. Glen Canyon's dam was built to meet this accounting obligation. And this, we're talking about the second largest reservoir in the country, Lake Mead being the first behind Hoover Dam. This massive 710-foot wall of concrete, one of the biggest public works projects in the West to ever be completed, it was built to fulfill an accounting obligation. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about it like that. And so you really have to, you really, when you look at Glen Canyon Dam from that lens, you're like, wow, maybe this dam didn't really make sense. Like, why did we build it? In the book Cadillac Desert by Mark Reisner, he notes that when this was completed in 1956, along with the other dams in the upper basin, like Blue Mesa, Flaming Gorge, Navajo Dam, the Aspinall Dams up in Colorado, the Colorado River system had more storage built up on it. Per the ratio of storage per actual flow of the river was higher than any other river system in the world. So that means they had more dams than they needed, essentially, than water actually flowed in the river. And then that's even before a climate change started depleting the river's flows. So Glen Canyon Dam is built, it's commissioned in 1956. And it serves as this mechanism for the upper basin states to bank their water in this bank account, effectively meet the delivery obligation and hold on to all the excess. That's why it's there for this water delivery purpose. It also, of course, is a hydropower producing dam, so it produces hydropower and helps pay off the construction of itself and these other dams. It provides reservoir recreation in this new, you know, artificial landscape known as Lake Powell. And the only people that actually pull water from the river is the tiny town of Page, Arizona, which today has about 7,000 people. And then there's the Lachine chapter of the Navajo Nation, which is there. But those are the only users of Colorado River water, which is very different from most reservoirs. I mean, like Lake Mead, you have Las Vegas pulls water out of Lake Mead, and it sort of feeds all these other reservoirs. But you know, a lot of people look at Lake Powell and they're like, oh, well, that surely that reservoir is feeding farms and cities around the world or around the region, but it's not. right? It's literally there just to meet this delivery obligation. And as I mentioned before, there were no environmental laws at the time, and nobody was really taking stock of what the impact would be. And it wasn't till after the dam was commissioned that the American public realized what was being lost in Glen Canyon, because Glen Canyon was one of the most amazing canyons on the planet. They should have never built that dam. It was a fool's job from the beginning.
So how you said that the dam is, I think, 700 feet. So how much what was at its highest point the distance between the top of the dam and the top of the water? And what I'm getting at is how deep was the land drowned?
In its deepest part, I think it was about 600 feet, because full pool of Lake Powell is 3,700 feet above sea level, and then the original river bed channel, I think, was 3,130. So, yeah, just I'm not great at math. A little under 600 feet.
So, and what was the rough area inundated?
I believe the area inundated was 160,000 acres. So I mean, it
So.
was really like an inland sea. And I know that number because I follow these spatial charts. It's in acres, which is a little bit harder for people to comprehend, but when it was full, it was the second largest reservoir in the country.
Okay, did you say 160,000 acres?
Yes.
Okay, so 640 acres in a square mile, 6,400 in 10 square miles, 64,000 in 100 square miles, and you said 160, so it's 250 square miles about.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Massive. I mean, it is a massive landscape. And it's if you were to look at a cross section of the canyon, it's sort of shaped like a martini glass. And so a lot of the storage capacity is in the top 50 feet. Like the majority of the storage capacity of this reservoir is in the top 50 or 100 feet. And so when it was really full, they even went past full pool in 1983 when the dam almost was overtopped by the reservoir. They put up plywood walls against the dam to brace it. This was covered pretty famously by Kevin Fidarko in the Emerald Mile book. Really, really amazing book. I encourage everyone to read it. But they talk about how, I mean, Glen Canyon Dam was probably days away from falling over because it was being overrun by this huge inflow from the Colorado River. So at that time, they braced up, they kind of made it so there was 10 more feet of storage capacity. So really, the true full pool is probably 3,710. And at that time, you can still see remnants when you go around in the canyons of Glen, and where you can sort of see where the full pool was. And it's so far away from where the reservoir is now that it's hard to imagine that it ever went up there. But I mean, it went, miles and miles up all of these side canyons and tributaries.
So I don't think there's any way for you or anybody to answer this question, but it seems that if you have a river, so how deep was the Glen Canyon, was the Colorado River there when it was before 1963? Was it 10 feet deep, 15 feet deep, 20 feet
Yeah,
deep?
probably something like that. I mean, it's such a sediment-rich river, and the bed of that river is going to change a lot year to year depending on how big of a seasonal flow you have. Most of the sediment that comes down this river system comes in May and June, and it can deposit, in a big water year, it can build up a whole new beach system where there wasn't one before, and then, the next year it could scour it away. So it's such a dynamic environment there. It's hard to say that the average depth is this or that, but in some places, and especially, like on the Green River or the Colorado River, if you go in the fall when the flows are low, the river is like 1 or 2 feet deep for the majority of its width, and then you have to find the channel where it's 8 feet deep.
So what I'm getting at is that if you take this river system that's 1 foot to 10 feet deep or whatever, to 20 feet deep, whatever, and is based on pulses of water in the spring, floods, and then other times where it and it has evolved that way for, I don't know, let's take a just crazy geologic guess and say 2 million years or 500,000 years, whatever, it doesn't matter. If you have a system that's evolved like that, and now it is a static, a semi-static piece of water that's 600 feet deep, it's going to be a dead zone because nobody has evolved in. I mean, you could have a lake that's 600 feet deep that is 3 million years old, and somebody would have figured out a way to live at 600 feet below. But I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is this feels like it is the death of much.
Yes, absolutely. You're exactly right. Ed Abbey called it the Blue Death. The Bureau of Reclamation called it the Jewel of the Colorado, and Ed Abbey called it the Blue Death. And you see that when you're there. I mean, when you're on the reservoir, kind of motoring around and stuff, there are no trees next to it. You know, it's a dead zone, like you said. That's exactly right. And especially when it first recedes back. Like in the, you know, and you have times this reservoir fluctuates a lot, you know, 30 to 60 feet a year sometimes. And when you see when the water comes down, it is a dead zone. I mean, it just decimates what sort of habitat there was there before. And then, but in the riparian areas, these riparian corridors and the tributary canyons, you do see that life start to come back once it's given time. Even in a matter of a few years, we've start to see impressive return of native flora and fauna. And that's a big part of our work too, is because most I mean the decision makers, the government agencies in charge of managing this place, aren't thinking about the ecology below that full pool elevation. It's sort of just looked at as an empty reservoir. And part of our work is trying to show the world that it's so much more. So one of our big projects right now is a vegetation survey in a bunch of canyons. I think we have almost 100 sites in like 20 different side canyons, you know, with transects going up these canyons, doing area cover data, looking at the type of flora that's returning. And what we're finding is that, you know, in the beginning, you do see invasive grasses and bushes and, you know, tumbleweed, Russian thistle, a lot of that. But after 2 to 3 years and 5 years, you start to see more willows and cottonwoods come back, and they start to dominate the ecosystem in places that have been out of water for 20 years. So these are areas above elevation 3660 about. They've been out of water for almost 23 years now, and there are whole forests that have come back to life. 60-foot tall cottonwood trees, groves of willows, so much vegetation that you would never even think that it was under this reservoir. The famous bathtub ring on the walls is a calcium deposit, and a lot of places that gets washed away. And in these restoring canyons, we're seeing a ton of wildlife. I mentioned the buck deer I saw in the cathedral in the desert, but there's beaver and, you know, dragonflies and damselflies and bees and bugs, and oh man, it's this place is just teeming with life. So for me, it's a place of inspiration. It's sort of like, no matter how big of a mistake we can make as a human race, like we have nature will always find a way to bounce back, and it's just an incredible thing to witness.
So before we talk about the reduction in water depth over the last couple of decades, how did, to the best of your knowledge, how would those various fish who required a river system or the insects, how did they survive the conversion into a reservoir? Did they all flee up into the tributaries? And
Oh
sort of
man,
live
I
up
mean
there.
there are some historical accounts of there's like one account where, you know, people were going to visit. It took 17 years for Lake Powell to fill. It really didn't fill up until the late 1970s. And it or even the early 80s, but there was one account where there's like all these scorpions that had all gotten trapped up on this one isolated rock patch and just slowly drowned. So, I mean, presumably many of them drowned or were pushed upland. I mean, nobody really knows. We weren't doing any sort of monitoring back then. But yeah, I mean, you can't understate the ecological impacts of this dam. And many people have said, which is sort of subjective, but it's the single most environmentally damaging project in our country's history. And, you know, at the time, the government was trying to build dams everywhere on this river system. The Bureau of Reclamation and the Army Corps of Engineers were just on a dam building tear around the country. They were trying to compete, you know, these two agencies were sort of competing against each other, trying to build as many dams as possible. Forget the consequences, forget the cost. You know, none of that mattered. It was just all about build, build, build. And it was very much a part of the kind of post-World War II mentality. Charles Wilkinson called this the big buildup, where you have, you know, the country's building our freeway system, we're building nuclear plants and coal plants all over the place. And it's just like we wanted to just build up our industrial capacity as much as possible. And so very little thought was given to the impacts. But, you know, we basically put a blockade of sediment from moving downstream. That's one of the biggest problems with Glen Canyon Dam is the sediment. The Colorado River is one of the most sediment-filled rivers in the world. And well, we sort of think of sediment as a problem, or most agencies do, but sediment is what brings the nutrients. Sediment is what provides the nutrients for the base of the whole food web. And so that's what's wrong with the Grand Canyon downstream, is that those native fish species evolved in warm, silty water. And once that dam was completed, the water that came out of the dam was came, you know, it's cold and clear, and there's no sediment in the river downstream. So it completely flipped the ecosystem upside down of the Grand Canyon, and that's why we had those endangered fish species.
So next, I want to talk about the reduction over the last 20 years through climate change. But before that, can you talk a bit more about the importance of flooding? And I only know a little bit about it. I mean, I know about it in general, but for the Colorado River, I know several years ago or a couple decades ago now or something, they started releasing pulses of water to try to mimic floods. I don't care whether you talk about that, but can you talk a bit more about the importance of flooding to creatures and river systems who evolved with flooding?
Yeah, so the seasonal floods are sort of like a crucial weather, you know, natural component to desert riparian ecosystems. This is a really sediment-filled river, but most of that sediment comes down during the spring runoff. 80% of the Colorado River comes from snowmelt, from the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, that so every year we have the snowfall happening upstream in Colorado and Wyoming. And then when May, June, July roll around, all that snow runs off, usually in a big pulse, and that pulse will bring a lot of nutrients down. So that can, you know, build beaches, which are really important ecologically. And it's basically transporting all the nutrients from the upper basin, just transporting those down through this river corridor, which you know provides a nutrient base for the bugs, which provides food for the fish and for the birds and so on. And it's a really critical component of it. When Glen Canyon Dam was completed, there were no more floods in the Grand Canyon, and frankly there was no more sediment in the Grand Canyon. The only sediment that is in the Grand Canyon today comes from tributary rivers, namely the Paria, which is pretty close to below Glen Canyon Dam, the Little Colorado, and then, you know, some other tributaries. And so after the Grand Canyon Protection Act was passed in the 90s, they started doing what are called high flow experiments. They do experimental floods, not to actually release sediment out of the dam, but to just stir up sediment in the canyon. And so what they do is they wait for the Paria River to flood usually, and then they'll open like extra releases out of Glen Canyon Dam, and they'll let these huge pulses of water go down and stir up sediment in the canyon. And there's been a little success with that. I mean, given the constraint of that 700-foot wall of concrete, like there have been some successes. And I think, I know a lot of the people that work on those floods, and it's, I don't want to downplay the importance of that work because they're keeping Grand Canyon alive. But when you're looking at like long-term solutions for this river system, I don't think it's a long-term solution. It's more of a band-aid solution, but it's a very important band-aid solution. And as climate change continues to put pressure on this river system, it's going to be harder for them to do those floods. I think they've only done 8 of them, even though the conditions were right to do about 16. So we've actually had these conditions to do more floods than we've actually done. And part of that is because of the hydropower interest. The agencies that market that hydropower don't like doing those floods, frankly, because when you're releasing that water out, you're releasing it from the river outlet works, which are closer to the bottom of the dam. They don't generate electricity. So there's this big cost of releasing this water that's not generating electricity to stir up sediment downstream.
So how much has the, thank you for that. How much has the reservoir declined in height over the past couple of decades?
So at its peak, in 1983, right, it got up to like 3710. Some people say 3713. And then in the spring of 2023, at its low point, it dropped down to 3519. So that's almost, that's 170, 180 feet below full pool. Going back to our kind of area coverage of acreage, that's almost 100,000 acres of land that was once inundated came back out again. So this reservoir, which took 17 years to fill, through the 1970s, it kind of gets full around 1980. It almost overfills in 1983. Through much of the 80s and 90s, it's full, very full. Lake Mead and Lake Powell are very full, to the point that water managers are kind of getting stressed out about it and are hoping for some dry years. Then, it's just like a switch turns in the year 2000. We start to get a series of dry years: 2000, 2001, 2002 is really dry, 2003, 2004. All of these are really dry years in the Colorado River Basin, and Lake Powell, just the levels just drop like a brick. It went from 99% of capacity basically in 1999 to 34% of capacity in 2005. And at that time, this is before people understood the impacts of climate change, and the decision makers and stakeholders in the basin just said, "Wow, this is a crazy drought. I mean, this is wild." And we know that droughts happen on this river system. It's a notoriously fickle river system where some years it'll have huge, huge flows, and then some years it'll have hardly any flows at all. And it sort of, has this very drastic fluctuation. That's normal. That's natural. But as the climate gets warmer, we're starting to just see less runoff. We don't really know what climate change does to precipitation patterns as well, but we do know what it does to snowmelt runoff, and it reduces it. And that's what we're seeing. So really starting in the year 2000, Lake Powell starts this decline. 2000, 2005, the end, 08, 09, 10, 2011, we have a series of good water years, and it kind of comes back up. And then it sort of starts to go down and crash again. And it sort of had this, more or less up and down, but a downward trajectory to last year when it hit its record low of 3520 or 3519. And there are some important thresholds with this reservoir. It can't just like gently glide down back to river level because there are some big things that need to be considered when that happens. At elevation 3490, that's the elevation that it can no longer generate hydropower. And it also it is its ability to release water downstream becomes constrained after that point. The access to the river, to the canyon, to the reservoir around those elevations becomes much trickier. And there are all these important questions about what happens with Glen Canyon Dam and with this river system at those levels. And so far, the solutions haven't really been to think about life after Glen Canyon Dam or how to modify it or how to change it. It's more been like, how do we just keep water in there? And so even for the past, 10 years, in a concerted effort, agencies and states have been working to, quote unquote, fill Lake Powell, keep water in the reservoir, but it hasn't really been working. And last year, water year 2023 was one of the biggest water years in a decade. It was this biblical water year on the Colorado River Basin, like 170% of average runoff, I think. And even after that huge water year, the combined storage of Lake Powell and Lake Mead was only 36%. And it would take probably six of those years to refill these reservoirs. And the best climate data that's coming out is showing us that, we're probably going to see drier and drier years on this river. And that so there's just going to be more pressure on these reservoirs. So what Glen Canyon Institute is proposing is that we actually modify Glen Canyon Dam, not tear it down, but, re-engineer it in a way that it can be fully drained and that the river can flow freely through Glen Canyon and through Grand Canyon, and the structure would remain in place, as a sort of last effort flood control if it were needed, like an emergency flood control mechanism. And I think we're starting to see decision makers and other groups and other stakeholders start to take this idea more seriously. And on the whole Colorado River system, the story is all about decline and depletion, and everybody has to take cuts, and we're losing this and we're losing that, and everything's so hard, and there's habitat loss. But in Glen Canyon, we are seeing something come back. We are gaining something new. We're seeing the return of this place that should have been a national park. We're seeing a return of all these tributary rivers and these riparian corridors. I mean, they're coming back to life, and it's incredible. And so instead of clinging to what I would consider this massive environmental mistake, which is Glen Canyon Dam, which was built for this antiquated accounting framework that we put on ourselves, right? We did this dam was never really necessary. And at low elevations, it's going to be causing all these big problems. And it seems that that low elevation future is almost inevitable. And so what we're saying to the public and to decision makers is, let's start thinking about what comes after Glen Canyon Dam. Let's start thinking about how to transition away from this Glen storing water in Glen Canyon. Let's talk about naturalizing the Grand Canyon. Let's talk about finishing the restoration of Glen Canyon upstream, and do it in a way that makes it as smooth as possible for the ecosystems and the stakeholders of the basin.
So I think that there is increasing momentum toward dam either removal or decommissioning, or however we work it. That's happening right now on five dams just south of here on the Klamath. And we know that these have been spectacular successes with the Elwha and with a ton of dams up in along the East Coast. And so you said that policymakers are beginning to listen, and I don't, can you talk about that a little bit? Because I mean, as having been an activist since the late 80s, early 90s, I lived in Spokane, Washington, and was advocating for removing the dams on, along the Columbia, and they've been arguing about that for 40 years, but there's been no movement, no real movement. And are you actually making some headway in terms of discourse and response, not from environmentalists, but from policymakers?
We are. And mostly it's happening in private. It's not happening in a very public way, at least on the end of the decision makers. And it kind of goes back again to that purpose of the dam, because the stakes at Glen Canyon, it's really not about recreation. It's not about hydropower so much. It's about a mistrust between the upper basin states and California. I mean, This is like a culture of distrust that is so baked into the American West that it's hard to undo. And so it's not an en like th it is an engineering challenge, but th it's a like and from an engineering standpoint, this is like a like they could do it, right? There are a bunch of ecological questions, you know, like it's not like you could just flip the switch and then the Grand Canyon goes back to what it was. That transition would be really complicated, and frankly, there will be some messy years in between. Going from this artificial Grand Canyon that we have today and then the naturalized Grand Canyon. And then, but this, it's all about this policy and this mistrust of these basin states. And so it's really, you know, I love seeing the Klamath dams and, you know, what's happened with the Elwha. And I mean, you're right. We're seeing a sea change in the way that the public perceives dams. And, you know, it also, it's a reminder how long it takes because those fights have been going on for decades. And we're finally seeing it happen. And, you know, a lot has to go right for those types of river restoration efforts to take place. And I think what's working in favor of Glen Canyon is that they're going to have to do something. And so last year, we came out with a report a couple years ago that showed that at a certain elevation, the dam physically can't release enough water downstream to meet that delivery obligation, that, you know, that reason that it was built. At a certain elevation, it can't fulfill that because it wasn't designed to operate at low levels. It was designed to operate in the sweet spot and it not for like our depleted climate change river that we have now. And so it turns out that Glen Canyon Dam, in the form that it is right now, is this huge bottleneck for this river system. It's a big liability. It used to be seen as an asset, but the lower this river gets, the more it becomes a liability. So there's an incentive for the stakeholders in the basin to take this idea seriously. And last year, during an EIS on the management of the dam, we saw the lower basin states come out and say, hey, we should look at re-engineering Glen Canyon Dam so that it can, you know, flow at lower levels. So they're not saying, let's drain Lake Powell. They're not saying, let's restore the river. Those decision makers don't necessarily care about the environmental part of it, but, you know, they're probably only going to modify that dam once. And there are so many problems that need to be solved doing it that it wouldn't make sense for them to re-engineer it and not allow for the passage of sediment and to just fix the Grand Canyon downstream. And so they might seem like really incremental steps in the right direction, but I think it is moving in that direction. And like I said, you know, last year we got within 30 feet of minimum power pool. And once, you know, it will happen eventually. That dam will stop generating hydropower. And when it does, there's going to be a really big paradigm shift. People are going to start, you know, waking up and smelling the aridification. We don't call it drought anymore because droughts are temporary. We call it aridification because it's a climate trend. You know, it's a warming basin. The runoff from snowpack is depleted. The moisture in the soil is less because the atmosphere is thirsty, where it's just a hotter basin than it used to be. And so people are starting to come around to this. And I think people are also starting to see the rejuvenation of Glen Canyon upstream and the opportunity there. And I think with those elements combined, the future is very bright for Glen Canyon.
Great. And that would be a great place to end, but I have one little question, which is if people are interested in either supporting that movement or supporting Glen Canyon Institute, how do they find out more about the work you're doing?
You can find us at our website, glencanyon.org. You can get in touch with us. I would encourage you to get on our email list. We send out a newsletter every month, keeping people up to date on our work and big things happening with the river. We're on, you know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or X, or whatever it is now. We're on all social media platforms. We'd love for you to follow us and get involved with our work. We've got volunteer opportunities regionally. We do a lot of events and programs. We're doing some presentations around Utah, Moab, Flagstaff, Colorado this spring that we're really excited about. So we'd love for folks to get involved. You can email me, eric@glencanyon.org. We want you all to be involved with our work and be a part of the biggest river restoration in American history.
Well, that's great. And thank you so much for saying all that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Eric Balkin. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.